to share the podium with Rabbi Lipiansky, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Gdol of Greater Washington. And I have to say that every year the Talmidim wait for Rabbi Lipiansky to come and to give us chizuk, and he does so in a very different manner than most of the Rebbeim who speak here. Most of the Rebbeim who come, Baruch Hashem, they give a tremendous amount of chizuk. They prepare and they give over a shir style type of sicha chabura. But here we have really a tremendous chud to have one of the gdolim in America to come and share with us his wisdom and to draw out questions and shailas that we have about Torah, about Yahadut, really about any aspect of Judaism and of our lives, and to be able to hear his responses that are so focused and that are filled with a tremendous amount of sensitivity, but also with a lot of encouragement and support. We want to thank you very much for coming. I also just want to make mention that Adam Sreg, who is our alumni, is here visiting the yeshiva as well. He attends the Yeshiva Gedola. If anybody has any questions about the Yeshiva Gedola and about his accomplishments and what you yourselves, for those of you who do not know where you're going, if you want to consider the Yeshiva Gedola of Greater Washington as a possibility, then you can certainly speak to Adam, and I'm sure Rabbi Lipiansky as well. And Rabbi Kiffin, what did you say?
Kiffin.
Okay. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Rabbi Lipiansky.
I came at the tail end of the siyum, so chazak v'amatz, whoever made the siyum, my late brother, Rav Nosson Tzvi Zichrono Livracha, would do anything for siyumim, and he would prepare personally the mesiba siyum, and the quality and quantity of food was commensurate with the accomplishments of the siyum itself. So siyum hashas would get a grand feast, but it's a tremendous seg, and you should go mechayel lechayel. I also want to echo the words about Adam. It's been a wonderful relationship with the yeshiva here. Adam is a local boy from Silver Spring. He went to the high school there, came here, grew tremendously, came back, and it's been growing tremendously, Yeshiva Gdola, and he had a few weeks off and came running back here to get Avir Eretz Yisrael. It's been a wonderful relationship, partnering in such a Ben Aliyah, and Bezos Hashem, you should all have the same type of atzlacha that Adam has wherever you are and wherever you continue. And just one thing about, I guess, the question and answers, I want to just make a ha'ara that I think is appropriate for the Olam, but that I found, you know, this, it sort of happened by accident. One year they asked if we can do question and answers, and that's sort of the way it started. You have Arba Banim, and each one has his question. I once thought there are three Lashonos of questions in Lashon Kodesh. There's a Shaila, there's a Kasha / Pircha, and there's a Tmiha. And the difference is as follows. A Shaila means I'm using the question as a tool to explore further. If this is so, how do you deal with this? Tosfos, when he asks a question, is saying, since I have a sugya this way here and a sugya this way here, then obviously there are more details in the halacha that will help me qualify this halacha in this place and this halacha in this place. There is a tmiha, which means I can't even ask an intelligent question. The word tmiha comes from the word tam, which means whole. It's like you walk in and you see this big complicated machine. You don't ask, like, why is this screw attached to that bolt? You say, what is it? I don't have any way to even digest it and process the question and sort of analyze. That's called a tmiha, from the word tam, which means complete. I'm swallowing the whole thing whole because I can't figure out the bits and pieces of it. And then there's a pircha or kushya, whose angle is to destroy the thesis that you presented. So the Chacham is a shoel. He asks a question because he wants to explore, and he realizes he can't just listen to the Torah and that's it. He needs to ask, and in a dialogue will come to a much finer truth and a much more detailed truth. The Rasha is out to knock, and it's a kasha and a pircha, and that's what he's doing. He's using the question as an axe to destroy whatever thesis is being presented to him. And a tam is somebody who's a tamea, and he doesn't even have the vocabulary to sort of analyze the issue and ask details. The chacham asks the chukim, the edos, the mishpatim. Tam says mazer, and that's that. And Einar Delishol is off the chart. He doesn't even have any questions to ask. He's not even intellectually sensitive to ask the question. I've found it energizing because I found that Olam's questions are to the point. I think they're intellectually honest. They want to figure out the truth, willing to hear different sides. And it's, you know, sometimes the questions are just pro forma, sometimes they're listless, sometimes this. The Olam here seems to have a very healthy sense of it. And it's been a pleasant experience for me as well. So last time we had a Sarah Kashis, so how did we work it? Someone had questions written down or whatever. I don't have anything. I'm fine.
Anybody have any questions you'd like to raise?
About what?
About anything in Yadus.
Yes.
Why does it seem like the Torah sometimes talks about things that are don't seem so significant? Sometimes they even repeat those events, whereas the Torah doesn't want to mention the Mashiach or Olam Haba.
Okay, your question has two parts. We'll make a shayla, we'll analyze it. They're not. One is, why does the Torah bring things that seem very insignificant and sounds repetitive? A lot of their parshas are repetitive. Secondly, why is there no mention of Mashiach Olam Haba? Each one stands on its own. It's each one is a separate question. Let's start with the first one. There's a Chazal mentioned the issue, and they specifically referred to Eliezer and Avram, his conversation repeated twice, not terribly important conversation, and so on. Chazal used a term that, you know, the Sichas Avodim of the Avos is better than the Torah of the children. I want to explain what the Pshat Net is. A person can suffer a cut in a hand without great damage. A person can even suffer chas v'shalom severing a limb and still live quite well, you know, a bit handicapped and so on. A gene that gets spliced, that gets cut, even a small way, is destructive in the entire body because it's very seminal. This is the core of what you're building. Avos are, Klal Yisrael is built in layers. And the Avos built the genetic material of Klal Yisrael. Anyone who's a child of Yaakov is Jewish, whether he likes it or not, he's Jewish. And anyone who's not a child of Yaakov is not Jewish. That means that the genetic composition of Klal Yisrael, metaphysical if you wish, but genetic is the right description of it, is set through Avos. And anything that happened with the Avos down to the small details is very significant. If you look at it, the Torah describes a life of 100 plus years for each of the others in a few short stories. So we need to tell ourselves the Torah has selected these pieces as being the significant ones. The repetition has significance. And yes, you need to break your head on it to try to understand it. The very fact that the Torah has picked only a few events and a handful of events to cover 175 years is in itself telling. Sometimes we figure it out, sometimes not. I want to give an example. The Rambam in Mor Nebuchim actually points at a half a dozen places in the Torah. The Torah seems to deal with such inane matters, such silly trivia. What's the point of it? And the Rambam in Mor Nebuchim is very powerfully points out how important these things are. I would like to take a minute and to maybe share two approaches that are very significant. Both are Divrei Elokim Chayim, both are real Torah, and very significant in teaching us how important Torah is. There's a parasha at the end of Vayishlach. Somebody so nicely put a Tanakh here. Must have been pre-thought. I will ask permission from Gottlieb. You also David Gottlieb? Dov Gottlieb. Thank you. Permission received. I'm very happy. There's a parasha at the end of Vayishlach. Since it's by Shvi, we're already probably lost in thinking about the Kiddush when we get to it. It goes, these are the kings that ruled in Edom before there was a king of Bnei Yisrael. In Edom, you had Bela ben Baor, who comes from the city Dinhaga, and then you had Yovel ben Zarah from Basra, and the king that came after him is Chushim from Taimani. It gets so bad that at the very end, you have the last king is Hadar, who comes from a city called Po. He has a wife named Mehetavel, a mother-in-law named Matret, which is a really fitting name for a mother-in-law, Melashon Tirda, and this and that, Matret is really good. Bas Mezahav, which is also very good for in-laws. But the Torah lists this. Why? Who? What? When? Where? The Torah before, also, it goes through all the alufim of Esav, who the generals were, and who the and Yoash and Yalam and Korach and so on. What are these parshas doing here? I want to show you two terutzim from two different halakim of Torah, and each one is powerful, extraordinarily powerful. The Rambam speaks about both of them, but I want to focus on the teretz for the first parsha. He explains both. The Rambam says the Torah did not allow us to kill anyone. The only people that not only are allowed to kill and were mechuyev to kill is Amalek. He said Amalek is a complicated nation. They intermarried. They were Esav's children, grandchildren. There was a lot of marriage between all sorts of different nations. Those different nations had there was a mishmash and a hodgepodge of half Amalek, half Edomi, a little bit Amalek, a lot of Edom, and so on and so forth. And that was natural. He said, so when we go and fight Amalek and we capture someone, so we're going to have to kill Amalek, but maybe it's not really Amalek. And the Torah, said, did not want us to spill one drop of blood that is innocent. And we have to understand something. Amalek and Esav, it's not that Esav is big tzaddikim. If they married with Amalek and they're cousin with Amalek, it's probably like Inver Geffen. They're similar, but they're not Amalek. And killing a person is a terrible thing. And if the Torah said Amalek, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was gozer. So he said, so we have to sit down, and the Torah gave us a genealogical chart to weed out the innocent people so that we don't kill innocent people with Amalek. There's no kill is not a Jewish word. It's exeris hakasev that we kill Amalek, and killing someone who is almost Amalek is shfichas damim, and that's the attitude. That's what the Torah is giving us here. That's the Rambam Mor Nevuchim. Extraordinary. The Arizal was coming with a different chelak Torah. Ne'elavel divrekim chayim. The Arizal has it's not a sefer, but it's a whole sugya that the world was created in a way that Ra comes before Tov. And every Madrega of Tov had a Madrega of Ra before. Vayera, Vayvoka. First as a night, there were 2,000 years without Torah, then there was Torah. The world, the process of the world is from Ra to Tov in that way. Edom, Esav, who are the core of Ra, ruled the world for 8 Tkufas. And that came before the Tkufa of Klal Yisrael. And each and every one, each name over here, has significant remuzin, down to the Matreda and the Mezov, extraordinary remuzin. And once you see it, you see clearly of understanding that structure of what points of Ra, we don't need his vocabulary, Ratzfiris and so on, but just understanding that, the Torah locked it into something which is the Malchus of Rishus of Esav. There were eight kings before there was a king. The last one was called Hadar, which means to return. It's the returning of the Malchus to Klal Yisrael. Extraordinary. A world of Sodos that is really the fundamentals of many of the Sodos of Kabbalah, Allah in this parasha. So here we have a parasha seems insignificant. You look at it and it raises your eyebrows and you rightfully ask yourself, what is it? But the question is, what don't I understand rather than why did I write it? Yes, the Torah wouldn't have written nonsense and wouldn't have written things that are unimportant and trivial. So what am I missing? The Rambam's answer, we might figure out ourselves. The Rizal's answer, you have to have a Minashamayim, a Gil like that. But we have one place where we see something like that, and it's really extraordinary. I'm always very moved by this when I go through the parasha. Both the Rambam is very meaningful to me, and the Rizal is very meaningful. Yes.
The Torah
focuses on Klal Yisrael, but the events are universal. In the very core of the world, what should have been Gan Eden was started with Adam not listening to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and with Cain killing his brother out of jealousy. The world hasn't shaken off that event yet. The Ramchal explains that the development of Klal Yisrael is meant. The world today is a nasty place because thanks to us. Us means Adam collectively. We messed it up. We use free choice betting. And once you build in a poison, once killing becomes something that's possible, it takes its toll. Our Klal Yisrael's mission was to produce a much better nation. There will be a light to the Goyim. But all around the world is a manifestation of it gone wrong. Once Ritzicha became, at the very core, the first two people that could kill each other killed each other. Well, one killed one. You can't kill each other. Then it became. So all that we see now, the idea of war, the idea of hatred, most jealousies are in that way. I want to correct one point you're making, though. When we speak about genocides, I want to speak about something unusual about a reason why we need to reserve the term. So don't use the word genocide, the other terms. It is not unnatural for two, like the Palestinians and us, it's not unnatural that we're enemies. They want this place, we want this place, and the Tutus and the Hutus want each other's place, and so on and so forth. It is unthinkable that Nigerians would land in South America to kill Brazilians. It would make no sense. Neighboring place, people warring on each other for money, for religion, for all these things, that's part of Sinna and Kinna, and that's part of the around the world. The idea that Hitler would send people to Greece to kill Jews and to every far-fetched area to schlep them back, That was an incredible event that has no parallel. He was looking to kill the Jews in every single corner in the world. It wasn't Germany. His war against Czechoslovakia, he wanted a piece of land. Poland, he wanted a piece of land. He wanted land, he wanted this. He didn't want anything from the Jews, he just wanted no Jews wherever they were. That's an event that's unparalleled in history. And it speaks something about Klal Yisrael having a special mindset that the ultimate Ra understands that Klal Yisrael is the ultimate Tov. You're right, the world has a lot of Ra, and the Shoresh comes from the world falling apart with the Chet of Cain and Hevel and so on. Yes?
My friend and I were having a debate over the past couple of weeks.
And you're still friends? Good, that's good, okay.
About what the nature of being chosen means, what it means to be gifted one. Specifically, we're addressing a very specific question. Which are they led to, which means, like, if you have a non-Jewish and newborn baby and a Jewish newborn baby, and they both die at the same time, without doing anything, which is more valuable in order to bring, you know, what it means to be Jew. So I want to know what your opinion about this. What does it mean to be Jew? Does it mean that we're, is there inherent value to us, or is it only because we do the mitzvot?
Okay. You'll tell me afterwards if I won or not. Between you and your friends, you'll let me know which side I it's one of the things that has made people, once we interacted with the world around us, very uncomfortable. It's not, people don't take kindly when you walk around with your nose up and say you're chosen. But the only, if you look carefully, we're chosen. The only thing that we got physical for choosing is that being chosen at Yisrael. But what we're chosen for is we're expected to keep almost 100 times as many mitzvahs as a goy. In other words, a goy who does Zayin Mitzvah Noach is a tzaddik. A Jew who does Zayin Mitzvah Noach is not a tzaddik. Let's leave it at that. We have an aptitude for a level of ruchnius that a goy does not have. It's not, there's nothing racist about it, because if we say yes, we're chosen, we have to put on tefillin every day, get up for davening every day, not do this, not do that, and so on and so forth. Also, anyone who has it in him to become part of us, the door is open. If somebody genuinely wants to become a Yid and take on. So we've been chosen to express a greater ruchniistic quality than Umas Olam can as a nation. It's like an elite unit, like Sayeret Matkal. They're chosen because they have the hardest and toughest missions and expected to be able to carry it out. We have the mission of living thousands of years as being downtrodden and keeping a burden of mitzvahs that most people would find unimaginable, and proudly doing so and saying this is what a person is supposed to be about. A person is supposed to be about Shabbos and about Kashrus and about Kedusha and so on and so forth. And you're welcome to join us if you feel moved to do so. The value, someone asked once the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I like the answer. He asked him, who's better? A Jew who's not doing what he's supposed to do, or a guy who is doing? And his answer was, are you talking about potential or actualization? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yom HaDin is down to people for what they are. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows and understands, and he's the Dayan Emes, and if you're a Rashi, you're Russian, if you're Tzaddik, you're Tzaddik, even if you're Musolam. But the potential that a Jew has is incredibly larger than Musolam. Certainly as a nation. I don't know one-on-one, and I certainly, we don't have the ability to measure these things. But the chosenness of ours means we're chosen for a spiritual mission that others are not believe. It's wrong to uphold a guy to do Tayag Mitzvahs. We have that mission. We have a mission to show the world what a super person looks like, so that they say, wow, if a person is spiritual, it's a very different world, and why don't we be like that? That's our mission. And we've had to go through a lot of fire and water for that. The only thing we were promised was Eretz Yisrael, because it's a makom of Kedusha. Every nation has its place, and it was just a question of which piece of land. Eretz Yisrael has its Kedusha, and that's why this is our place. That's the only thing we ever got for it. Yes? Did I guess right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, yes?
Tell me if I'm right. I'm pretty sure the Ramban says something about a Jew who does the smallest mitzvahs in Israel, living in Eretz Yisrael, is greater than a big Talmud Chacham or someone who does great mitzvahs outside of Eretz Yisrael.
It's a poor paraphrase. And let me explain what the Ramban says. The Ramban says, I heard somebody once quote this Ramban, that mitzvahs and chutzah is only Rabbanim. Shacharach says not like that. You don't go suffic lekula in kutzlaritz. Some people do, but the conventional psika is that all dinim deraisa are considered deraisa and rabban. Ramban says, in a shleimistika dimension, Ramban is talking in a hashkafa that it's supposed to fit in as part of a whole picture. I want you to understand. like we spoke about before, the main accomplishment of Klal Yisrael is as a klal, as an entity, as a nation. Individuals are not on the on the stage of history. Nations are. So we need to have a tzur of a nation, and that's when the mitzvahs take on their full expression, what they ought to be. He brings a chazal v'atziv lechot tzionim, which means make us of markers, because the fullness of it, it's a hashgafic perspective. It's not a halachic perspective. And certainly, you have to be weary of comparing the biggest person, the smallest person doing this and that. It does mean the shleimus of the mitzvahs is Eretz Yisrael, Klal Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. That's and the truth is, if we think about it, when Mashiach comes, we're going to be like Balei Tshuva. Most of the Torah we never mekayim. Not Karbanis, not Tumah and Tara, for many years not Tzroyim. You know, that's a major part of it, and we're kind of not, we're clueless. I mean, imagine somebody saying, don't touch that, that's Truma, don't touch that, you're a Tvil Yom, don't touch that. We don't know what we're talking about. It's something incredible. So it means the shleimus of the mitzvahs, the shleimus of the tzurah is. It's a perspective on it. You don't apply it like halacha l'maisa. It certainly tells you the value of Eretz Yisrael, so there's the value of living in Eretz Yisrael, but you can't just put it down in like it would be another sif in Kitzur Shomar. It's a different, it's a hashkafa to look at it. Yes? Okay.
Within most yeshivas, it seems like they have a big focus on Gemara, of course,
right, and
Machshava. Why is it that many yeshivas overlook studying Zohar and studying things that extrapolate Sod? Because that's a big, vast portion of Torah, I think, and it seems that it's a shame that people overlook it and people don't really care to look into it.
Okay, so let me start answering it with an anecdote. And there are some Hasidim, Ashlag Hasidim, who very strongly believe everybody should learn Zohar and Kabbalah and so on. And they push it quite aggressively. They sell Zohars very cheaply, and the whole set, and so on and so forth. And that's sort of their sheet and so on. So there's sort of an anecdote. And again, I take absolutely no... I give no guarantee to the veracity of it, but the point of the story is very true. So somebody got into it, and he learned a lot about it. And then the story is told by people in Tveria. For some reason, people in Tveria always kind of... In the starting from Gashash Achiver onwards, Tveria people are kind of the goofy people. So this is a story about a guy in Tveria. He comes one day in his shtibul, and he hears a guy saying the pasuk L'cha Hashem Agdulo V'Agvur, the first place Ahot, Kechol B'Shamayim V'Aretz. So he asks him, you're saying words. You don't know what it means. You never learned the Zohar Kadosh. You don't know what it means. And just blurting these words. What does it mean? Hashem Agdulo V'Agvur, V'Tiferet V'Zohar. So the guy was very embarrassed. He says, yeah, what does it mean? He says, okay, Gdulo is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's right hand. Gevurah is his left hand, Tiferes is his belly button. And there's a representation in Kabbalah using the body as a figure. And if you're coarse enough and crude enough, that's what you get. The understanding of it was Kabbalah is an inherently impossible thing to learn because you need terms and words to speak about things. But you're talking about things that don't physically exist. The metaphysical needs to be described if it's to mean anything, and yet your mind needs to have the refinement to strip it of any physical vestiges. The Zohar in one place, when he starts his limudim, his main limudim, he starts with the error of anyone who makes a pesel or masecha, because the limud is so easy to turn it avodah zarah, that it does more harm than good to spread it. The shita had always been to leave it for people, and the Rambam, who had a different world of soul, also agrees in his world of soul that you need to leave it to people who are already, whose mind has been refined by Torah. The Hasidim were the first ones in the literature world. The Goyen was a huge mekubel, and he wrote a lot in Kabbalah, and his Talmidim in Kabbalah, but it was kept very, very strictly on the lock and key for people they felt are of the caliber to understand it. It's very fine. It's you have to strip away all the descriptions and live with the abstractions. That's very difficult. The Hasidim felt they needed to do it because it would add spice, some spice to Kiyum HaMitzvahs that would make it more inspiring to people. The mashal they gave for making this more common was that sometimes the old days, they used to think that diamonds or jewelry have some therapeutic power. So say when the king's son is critically ill, he takes the crown jewel, grinds it into dust, mixes it into a portion and feeds it to him. You know, so we did wrong, but it was necessary to save the people by giving some of the ideas to give people a sense of how great a mitzvah is, what kind of tikkunim it does, and so on and so forth. There's been, like everything, there's been positive sides to it, there's been negative sides to it. The positive side is it has been inspiring to some degree. The negative side is two issues. One is hakshama, which means turning terms about Kadosh Baruch Hu into some physical reality, which is borderline kfira. That's a problem. The second problem is it sometimes knocks halacha in a place where it shouldn't knock halacha. A person will say, well, I know that I should be davening shachris now. It's kind of 10:30 in the morning, and you know the zman is rapidly moving forward. But I have to make some tikkunim, because it says, without the tikkunim, the shachris doesn't go up to Shemayim. Our understanding, and firmly so, is that's absolutely wrong. Halacha comes first, and the tochen of it comes second. And the issues, one of the machlokas in between Misnagdim and Chassidim hinged around this. By emphasizing the content, you sometimes short-circuit the halachic process. And, you know, it's an issue. There's positive value in both, a negative in the other. But by and large, a person needs to first start in halacha, his mind. I want to tell you something else also. Halacha, which I mean Gemara, teaches a certain intellectual honesty. There's no such... Gemara never asks a kasha and answers, well, Rabbi Nachman was a big tzaddik and he knew what he was doing. The Gemara says, Meisve, Eisve, you know, Tiufta. The Gemara, there's no... I once was speaking to somebody, a Reformed Jew was telling me, you know, the rabbis could be instituted and they could be mevatel halachas when they wanted to. I asked them examples of principle. I said, great, let's take a Gemara. The Gemara is Akasha, how could you be mevatel d'oraisa of Shemitah's Ksafim? I asked them three guesses what the Gemara's answer is. The rabbis were great, they were holy, they could do what they wanted to. The Gemara's answer is, you're right, they can't. Only if it's Shemitah Rabban they can do it. I said, the halacha teaches a person a certain intellectual honesty that you can't push whatever you want based... What is credentials? The Zohar is a closed sefer. The Zohar, even Kabbalah, is not an open sefer. The Arizal is open. The Zohar is mystical by all counts. You have to know pshat. You need to learn it with a lot of depth, unless you're trapped by something that doesn't mean. It has beautiful poetic language. The Arizal's lashon is dry and boring. It's not meant to entertain. It's meant to give over amitios in a certain way. The Zohar is a very inspiring language, but you can't take it at face value. You have to learn up the sugya, the Kabbalah sugya, and the Arizal is the key for that. So the Hasidus, the big Hasidic Rebbeim, have given a little dribble and drabble of the Inyanim to inspire us, but there is much good in keeping it away until a person is mature enough, emotionally mature enough, intellectually mature enough, totally mature enough to understand it. Yes. Yes. I'm sorry, you want to tell me?
I just had a follow-up question.
Please. Yeah.
Sorry. But you don't think that it's at least key to for Yeshiva to institute maybe classes to teach terms? Like you said, there's certain terms, certain things to build a foundation so that there's a prospect of more people learning certain things so that it doesn't become, you know, efficient.
There is what to be said about learning things that... So that there are persons, sometimes the Chassidus don't do it. Today, people are drawn to Chassidus, and if they don't find it in literature yeshiva, they know where to find it other places. You know, it's even something which, it has its places. Rav Huttner in the literature yeshiva world introduced he shied away from the terminology, but used a lot of the ideas. It's a process. You know, a tzibur doesn't jump in one instant. It's a process that takes place. I think it is taking place. It is influencing. People do have an awareness of a sfasemis on Chumash was never to be found in Yeshiva ever when I was growing up. Sfasemis was a sefer on Moed and on Kachim. That's what sfasemis was. No one had a clue that he actually wrote on Chumash. It was out of the pale of Sfarim. Today, every yeshiva kemat has one because it's become in. So it is a gradual process. I think there's a mutual hashpa. Yes.
Us as a nation are identified as Israel, right? Am Israel, Israel,
right.
Israel. But in the the first time that the term Yehudi was mentioned was in Megillat Esther.
Right.
So, and in reality, the term Yehudim stands for the word Yehudi, which is Yehuda, which is really 1/12 of Israel, Yaakov. So why did that become now the common terminology as our label?
So two things. First of all, what you mentioned, the main tribe that has survived until B.S. Goldsetic is Yehuda. That was the Yisrael disappeared, and very little we have of other Shvatim. Secondly, Chazal say that anyone who's Kaifin Avodah Zarah is Yehudi. As long as we're in Galus, our main Avoda, we don't realize ourselves. Our main Avoda is to stand strong against. A Jew in Galus has a hard time being identified as a Jewish people because we're sort of subsumed in other nations. We identify ourselves, we are not our host. And that's our strongest defining element. And I think that's why, that's another reason why we call ourselves Yehudim as opposed to Yisraelim. Yes.
So with regards to secular books and secular reading, now I understand that if a book has, let's say, inappropriate material or even innuendos, then it might be asur halakhically speaking. If a book lacks such ideas, then halakhically speaking, is it acceptable to read?
The answer is two things. First of all, if halakhically it's acceptable, then you're almost defining yourself. Halakhically, it's acceptable. You obviously want to understand why, if it's the Haredi world, there's a strong reluctance to read anything outside of Kodesh. So two or three, and like every, when you're dealing with a social phenomenon, social phenomenon meaning what people do, there are different reasons. If you look at the Rishonim, they were conversant with the their current science and philosophy works. Rishonim mentioned Aristotle very freely, and it's something you find in Akeda mentions it constantly, the Barbanel, and the Ramban will occasionally mention the Rambam for sure. First of all, it's very hard a lot of times to separate yourself out from real Goyish Hashkafis. I want to give an example. When I was growing up, dirty movies existed, of course. And they didn't invent them recently. You know, that's what we weren't supposed to do, and that's what some people did even though they were supposed to do. That's clear. The movies and the TV shows that was considered clean, kosher, lemahadrin, were Westerns. Westerns usually didn't have women, they had men dressed fully, shooting each other all day. Basically, that was the general theme. That sometimes this guy shot this guy. And it was good, it was fine, there's nothing not kosher about it. But think a little bit, if you think about it, what was the message of a Western show? The message was that if anybody talks down to you, you shoot him. Because you stand up for yourself. Real men stand up for themselves. And they don't let anyone, you think you're getting away with saying this? Bam. And nothing about that is Jewish. And if you tell yourself, if you say somebody's calling you bad names, but if you react, he's going to knife you. What should you do? Should I stand up and say I'm a proud Jew, or should you run? The Jewish answer is run. Really hard. You know, that's the answer. Rav Shach once put it into such powerful terms. He said, people accused us of being being kind of sniveling Jews, that when the parrots, said, you know, nasty things about us or whatever he did to us, we didn't react. We didn't stand up for ourselves. He said, you want to understand something? He said, we looked at a parrot like a dog with rabies. He was not human. His insult, for someone's insult to take effect on me, I have to respect the person. Gemara says, if someone who's a Talmud Chacham comes over and tells me, you know, what you said today was pure meratzes, I would be deeply insulted. If a guy can't read, says, oh, I think I'm Aretz type, I'd laugh. It's you know, we looked at the Paris as being a wild, crazy dog, and you run. But the attitude, you read a novel. So if the novel is filthy, so you know it's wrong. But if you don't, if not filthy, it's quite clear, it seeps in, that having an affair is normal. There hasn't been a novel where somebody didn't have an affair. There's no novel if there's no affair in the novel. So it begins, everything in the world expresses something, especially if it's written well, and it has in itself, you're getting the person's, a good novel that's worth reading is expressing descriptions of things. Descriptions, I mean, how you should, your perspective on something, how you should react. It's educational. A good novel gives a person insight into something. And it's very hard to say that if this person's ideas and ideals are very different, then, on the other hand, there's values a person learns how to write, a person learns truth, there are truths locked into it. So I guess the balance would be a person can read to educate himself, but not to lose himself in it. And when a person absorbs a lot of it, he begins to get a model of life that's not true to the Torah model. And it's the intangibles. Halachas, Hilchos Shabbos, can I eat this, not eat this, is easy to quantify. But is this attitude a Torah attitude or not, is hard because it's subtle. And that's why there was a great reluctance to, you know, there was a backing off. Now, when you back off, you sometimes back off all the way. But I'm saying that the attitude was, good writing always has in itself feelings and so on and so forth. And you need to look at the way Ricky Vega writes a tshuva. If you're capable of reading Ricky Vega's tshuvas, or his writings in general, are remarkable. Not for besides the Torah itself. On the one hand, his sharpness and directness is incredible, and his humility is incredible. In the same place where he goes to the heart of an Indian and asks a powerful kasha, he leaves off with Halavai HaKadosh Baruch Hu would open my eyes and I could see it. And it was not written, it was not rhetoric. This was Ricky Vega, this is what he was. It builds something in you. It's not, you know, some people write, well, and therefore I think this is wrong, and that's wrong, and I'm right. Ricky Vega writes, and I'm at step one. I have no idea where to go from here. It's an incredible lesson in humility when you learn it. And that's... So reading is very complex. It carries a lot of subtle messages, and not easy to sift out what's right from what's wrong. Yes.
So you know how Sifrei HaKodesh is going down the levels in Yiddish, and you said Mashiach sounds like they're coming slowly to get to a very, very low level. It shouldn't be the opposite way. It shouldn't be like getting higher and higher, and basically Mashiach.
You asked me what we ought to do? I didn't get the point of that question.
I'm not understanding the way it works, right? We're going to keep getting lower and lower, and Mashiach's going to come and we're going to be extremely low, right? And comply to the solid level, right? But shouldn't it be the other way? Shouldn't Mashiach not come until we get to a certain level and we shall be high enough so we can just...
So you're asking on the Gemara itself, not on what we should. So let me give you sort of a muscle, and we can figure it out that way. If your kid, you're trying to teach your kid how to swim, and you put him into water, you will leave him there until one or two things happens. One is, if he manages to swim across the pool and comes out, you say, bravo, great, excellent. If Chas V'Shalom starts drowning, you jump in and pull him out also. The Geula, at the end of the day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants Geula. We have two markers. Halavai v'matzliach. and Chas Hashem, if not, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not forsake us. Now, I want to relate to something to the point that he made. He quoted a Gemara now, Dor Shekula Zaka, Dor Shekula Chayev. It's never as simple as either or. Our Dor has deficiencies, our Dor has milus. In the big picture, I think in certain nekudas, Gula will be because was Zakai, and certain nekudas for other reasons. It's not black and white. The world is complex. People are complex. Chazal gave us parameters. They said Geula is something we can reach, and it's something HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never let us become forsaken. But exactly where and what and which areas and so on, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Cheshbonos. So we need to know, we need to live with two things. It's an ideal to live up to and to do what we can. Halavai, and every nekuda that was zocha to do right, it's a nekuda for Gula. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu won't forsake us. At the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu holds a hand, holds us up. Yes? Okay. I have no problem. It's everybody else that, you know.
For me, it seems that often there are like two very like opposite parts of Jewish thought. On the one hand, we believe that everything's supposed to be, you know, that the Torah is good, that God intends us, that the Torah is like supposed to teach like a better way of life. It's supposed to be like, you know, somewhat rational, and the Torah is supposed to be a good thing, and we're supposed to, you know, analyze and explain that vein. And then on the other hand, we have, I read a little bit of Yeshaya Leibowitz, who's, you know, whatever, he's
Get to the point. The quotes aren't important. The point's important.
Basically, like, you know, there's the other point, which is like you just accept God's word.
Right.
And you don't. You're not supposed to. And, you know, Abraham, when we talk about it, it's like the paradigm of Jewish existence, and like, you know, Jesus can't ask questions, and that's what a lot of people point to, like the greatness of Abraham.
Right.
He didn't ask questions when it came to that. So where do you find the balance between, like, you know, analyzing God's laws and like really, you know, making it your own and like respecting God's word and like, you know, not, you know, questioning?
Okay, very good question. I think the point that you're driving at is going to be a fundamental point on Amunah and a lot of other things. Let's flesh out examples. Imagine somebody comes to me and he says, "I'd like to borrow $1,000. Do you trust me?" I say, "Yeah." Could I have collateral? You have an iPad worth $1,200? I'll take that. When you give back $1,000, I'll give it back to you. That's certainly not trust. On the other hand, if a guy comes over in the park to me and he says, "Could I have $1,000? I'll give it back to you next week." And I say, "Sure, I trust you." That's not trusting. That's an idiot. I mean, what do you mean you're trusting? I mean, what does that mean? The real word trust means I've had business dealings with you and you were always good for your word. Now you come along, you want $1,000. I have no guarantee, but I have what to go on. If somebody comes and wants to sell me a religion, and his only thing is say, "Trust me, you can't understand. I'm God, I'm above it all." I mean, what do you want from me? On the other hand, if I can understand every bit of Torah and it makes perfect sense, and I could basically do it myself, then God's authorship is extra. It says in the Rishonim, I don't remember who it is, that they recognize the value of the chukim from the mishpatim that they see. If I see somebody is, and this is important when you go out to the world, and you're a frum Jew, and you carry yourself as a frum Jew, if you're a person who shows up on time, does their share work, doesn't shirk his job, is not fooling around with anybody in the office they're not supposed to fool around with, is not drinking, is a model on the level of rational understanding of what to be good is, then I say the tefillin that he's wearing, the tzitzis, the yarmulke, that must be very, very good. I don't know what they mean. I don't think he knows what they mean. But a mode of behavior that demonstrates so many positive facets, this must be good. If a person, however, is deficient in the other areas, let's say, then I question mechateset as tefillin and his tzitzis are of significance. our relationship with the world of mitzvahs, we need mishpatim to verify it for us, that it makes sense, that it's something worth pursuing. But if it's only mishpatim, then where's God in the picture? It's got to be chok. So the two together, you're right, they're opposite. And you're right, the Torah wants both. But the only way we have a relationship with God, to have a relationship means you need something in common, and God means something not in common. So in the answer, the practical realization of a relationship with God is a piece that I hold on and a piece that I don't. I want to say what I said in the words of Chazal. Chazal said that when Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the Luchos and by the Chet HaEgel, it says there were six fingers. Moshe held on to two, six handbreadths, sorry. Moshe held on to two of them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu held on to the other two, and two were in the middle. It's a metaphor. And the Maral explains, there's a part of Torah that's in our hand. That's Mishpat. There's a part of Torah that's Chok. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands. And that creates, like Shnayim Ochzin, the halacha is, whatever's in this guy's hand is his, whatever's in this guy's hand is his, and the middle is both together. The partnership is created because there's a part of Torah that's Mishpat given to us, and the way Bezer Shalmata Paskins, that's how the halacha is. There's a part of Torah that's Chok, and the way, and it's only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows it, and that creates a commonality and a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is incredible. We're holding on to part of it with our minds. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is holding on to part of it that we have no access to, and the whole, that picture together is a beautiful, beautiful vision of being in common, of being together. Yes?
This is in relation to his first question
about the
Jew and non-Jew.
Yeah.
So we learned
in our by the way, just what's the time frame? I mean, when do I start competing with the Jew? That's what I what?
No competition.
No competition.
If you have the time, then.
Okay, so you'll tell me when you think that the Olam needs to move on to better things. Sorry, who's the... yes, please, continue.
So we learned today in creation, that basically what happens is that if a Jew feels is like a Jew gang or something by a philosophy or something like that, you have a few to save it. Then it says that regarding a non-Jew, if the same thing happens to a non-Jew, you don't have a few. So I understand that, like, if you have priority, maybe, like, to the Jew rather than the non-Jew. But how is it that you want to view regarding the non-Jew also?
So the Rambam says in a place, and others, that Barbanel, I think, speaks about this quite at length. Generally speaking, let's take Ribbis as a prime example. Generally speaking, things that you would expect across the board in a society to happen, Jews and non-Jews are the same. Anything that's extra special, because, for instance, lending money with interest, it shouldn't be a bad thing. I mean, I can rent out my car, it's perfectly kosher. I can rent out houses. Why can't I rent out the money? So the Torah said an extra special chiyuv to give it to my brother because a brother deserves extra special treatment. Returning an aveda means I'm taking off time, effort. You know, for somebody else's financial loss, I'm taking a loss in time and effort and so on. It's an extra crediting. So you can't place a chiyuv on it. That seems to be the klal. For most things, that seems to be the dividing line between our chiyuvim klapi Jews and chiyuvim klapi goyim. It is considered, in a society where people return things, that's normal, it would probably be mechayev a Jew as well. But in the Bir Halachas, returning an object is something that's an extra effort. It's not just giving back, it's going looking for him, finding him. It comes with a whole package of Halachas. I think that's the dividing line. That's where anyone else... let me just... new people... I think you... yeah. Just loud a bit. I need to... yes. Just a bit louder. I can't. Yeah.
I see that in history has shown us that in times that you separate away from your phone, you're actually caught and killed because of them. And just like modern day examples, the history of Israel, I mean, the attack on the nation has been successful. The UK tried to launch an attack last year, but it was successful. The UK is still in the issues of conflict. We take a family and we build up a mind of system, but it kind of attacks the UK. And we do so on the fence, and we're in the worst of the world.
The answer is, yeah, sorry. So the answer to that is, it really depends. It should be, the decision for that should be rational and tactical. And I would like a cold army general who is totally impassionate and making a decision about what's the most sensible way. Sometimes it's sensible, you know, you have to be in a position where somebody's at you with a knife. Usually the most sensible thing is to run. Sometimes somebody's taking over a neighborhood, and if you give an inch, they will take more. The sensible thing is to organize a defense force capable of fighting. There were situations and times in the ghetto and in the war. It's noble, the people who fought to the end, but I'm here because my father lived through it. If my father would have made a heroic stand and died, my father was in the ghettos, my mother was, my father was a covenant ghetto, he went through the whole war, the concentration camp, the ghetto and everything. I'm here because he made a choice to live and to have a family again. If they would have done the heroic thing and gone up in smoke, I wouldn't be here, and my children wouldn't be here, and my children's children wouldn't be here. Klal Yisrael Bayis Sheni, Chazal point us that the right decision was to surrender. The other people said Krikim. There were other tkufos, here in Eretz Yisrael, it seemed to have been the right decision to stand up and to fight. But it should be made. Anyone who's smart knows that if you want to get the enemies to make a mistake, one of the Arabs' worst, one of their greatest weaknesses is that they become very quickly emotional. And that's why you can goad them, and certainly in the earlier years of the fighting the Arabs, that was the weak point. They fought on passion with very little seichel. And that's not good. In other words, when someone calls you a dirty Jew, You need to be able to sit back and say, what is the smart thing to do, and let's forget about the feelings over here. And it's a tough one. It should be made with seichel and not with somebody being able to goad your emotions. Yeah, and what else? Yeah, second question, sorry.
Yeah.
A little louder, I'm sorry.
So in regards to the value of life of a non-Jew.
Right. Well, I want to point out something, a perek in Tanakh. David HaMelech was considered to be not fit for building the Beis HaMikdash. And the reason was because he spilled a lot of blood. And he was a man of war. His battles were justified. There's a chinuch that says the reason why Kohanim and Levim don't take a chelik of the Biza, not only of the Nach, but the Biza. The chinuch says, because when you take Biza, when you take war booty from somebody, the person has a lot of hurt in Agmas Nefesh. And while it's perfectly legally okay that spoils go to the victor, but a man of God should have a different standard. And he shouldn't use things that somebody else that came with, I don't remember Lashon Tsar and Agmas Nefesh, I don't remember the exact ones, but that's more or less their favorite. It's important to understand that every drop of blood, the pasuk speaks about, you know, Dakash Rochus Dorish, every drop of blood, and so on. We do have another dimension of life, the Klai Sol, a neshama, that almost all don't have. But it's not meant to belittle the chshivas of Chaim in general. And it's very hard to go that fine balance. Yeah?
This is the last question.
Last question, okay. Aleo Hashtag, yes. Hey, who you?
As rational being in peace time, how do you understand the countless recent characters throughout our history? Meaning, like, we take like Vietnam soup and make time like the grand, like, just part of how we grew up. But just as rational.
Sense, In the Kalal is like this. There are two, again, your question has two parts to it, and I hate to keep doing it, but the question, one part is approaching the Torah rationally, and the second part is taking things in Torah literally. The Rishonim, the Aven Ezra, and many others say that in Torah, everything has to be taken literally, because at the end of the day, once you start saying something as a metaphor, there's nothing, everything falls off. Aven Ezra speaks about it, when he speaks about Aros HaLev, the only place that you can say is a metaphor is when the words are an idiom, like Arlas HaLev. But if Yetzias Mitzrayim is a metaphor, I would say that stealing is a metaphor. It means taking from poor people that can't afford it. But rich people in the banks, that's not real stealing. We have, you know, it's endless. You're finished. So Torah itself, Torah Shebiksav, is taking Kipshuto all the way. The question of being rational people, it's like Seichel has not eliminated the possibility of a nace in any sense of the word. No scientist can say there can't be a God and he can't do miracles. They haven't answered yet the great miracle. Me, you, him. Do you know what it takes to be me? Do you have any idea? I enjoy reading science for recreation. I don't do it for the drushes. I do it just, I happen to actually like it. And I'm sort of nerdy part, a little bit of a nerdy guy. I was reading recently, a certain worm has, I think, something like 385 neuron connections, and it's capable of extraordinary amount of complex activities. How, why, what, when, where? It's stunning. In a cell, there are something between 50 to 60,000 chemical reactions that are part of the process of living. The world is a stunning place. There's no rational, you can't say, well, we're rational, rational is good, and therefore there's no God, because not rational be God. That statement is horrible logic. We do need to approach things, so if somebody comes and tells me I can make the shtender float, I'll say, fine, let's try it. I'm game for that. It's clear to us, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, the Nisim are really are not explainable 100%. The fact that the Nisim have stopped is clearly indicated to us. This is our Masorah Torah, is there was a tkufa in the world where it was Nisim versus Avodah Zarah. You can never have a period where things are stacked overwhelmingly in the favor of belief or so on. So when we were doing Nisim, you had people who could do magic, pretend to do magic, whatever it is they were doing that looked Nisim-like. With the end of Bais Rishon, Nevuah came to an end, open Ruach HaKodesh, open Nisim in the Beis HaMikdash came to an end, and the world started dropping Avodah Zarah and becoming rationalist. And sort of the end of Bais Rishon, beginning Bais Sheni, was that process. And we got Torah Shebaal Peh, and we live with hidden Nisim. The fact that we're still here, history is a very strong nest, not an unnatural nest, but an extraordinary nest. And so when people say, well, we're rational, so we can't believe in Nisim, who said you? Rational just tells me I have not experienced a nest, a counted to have a nest in my life. That's a fair statement. But then to say because of that it doesn't exist, that's, you know, for years nobody thought of a black swan. It's a famous logic problem that, you know, if swan are white, but they discovered a black swan, so is it a swan or is it not a swan? Well, everything else matches with swans, and they discovered there were. Just saying that, I don't think it makes any sense, is a meaningless statement, and somehow it slips past our radar screen. That statement is illogical. Well, it doesn't make any sense to me to be Nisim, and since I'm a rational person, it doesn't make sense to me, so there can't be Nisim. There's no scientific proof in any sense of the word. It's not rational. Yes, you haven't experienced Nisim, and you don't have you don't have a culture of Emuna where things have been passed down. So, okay. And if you think about a person, you know, a person's life and thought and understanding and everything about us is mind-boggling. Okay, Rabbi say lech echol b'simcha lachmecha. Let's leave shtei lev lev tuvia nechol v'livel.
Also, I just want to, on behalf of the yeshiva, I want to really extend our karsa tov to Rabbi Lipiansky. And I think if we gain so much tonight, right, the message to all of us is very clear. We have to continue to learn, we have to continue to grow, we have to continue to strive for that connection with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. We're also zochet to have the Brechim who just came in now.